Support for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation and Stonyfield Farm.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios in Somerville, Massachusetts, this is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. The Kyoto Protocol to limit the emissions of climate-changing gases from most industrialized nations is now international law. The treaty went into effect on February 16th, a major milestone in a process that began in Rio de Janeiro in 1992 with the creation of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. The United States and more than 150 other nations ratified the Climate Convention, which called for voluntary reductions in carbon dioxide and other climate-changing gases, but it quickly became clear that the voluntary approach wasn't working. So in 1997, the convention met in Kyoto, Japan, and set mandatory limits, starting with industrial countries. But it would take another 8 years to ratify the treaty and put it into force, and along the way, the U.S. pulled out of the deal. Still, aside from the U.S., Australia, and Monaco, the world's more than 30 industrialized nations now have until 2012 to cut their climate-changing gases to levels below those seen in 1990. With us now to explain just how they'll do that is Vijay Vaidheswarando, an environment and energy writer with The Economist magazine. He joins us from an energy conference in Houston. Welcome to Living on Earth, Vijay.
Hello there.
What about the businesses in these industrialized countries bound by the Kyoto Protocol? How are they responding to the challenge of Kyoto?
The companies in Europe are particularly energized to deal with climate change because now for them it's the law of the land. They don't have a choice. As of January 1st, every company in Europe has a specific number, a target that they've been given, broken down sector by sector, company by company, power plant by power plant for how much greenhouse gases they can emit. And that makes it very easy for a manager to focus on it. And the old adage at Harvard Business School is, what matters gets measured. And frankly, in America, because there is no legal constraint on carbon dioxide emissions, companies don't have to measure their CO2. If you're a manager, you don't even have to know how much greenhouse gas you produce. And so we're a world away from where Europe is, where every single company beyond a certain size knows exactly how much they emit, what processes. And once you begin to think about it, they often find there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. That is, there are a lot of easy cuts they can make just by changing a process here or doing something over there a little more efficiently. And a lot of companies are finding they save money. Companies like BP, the big oil company, found that it was able to make big cuts in emissions savings, and they actually saved money that went straight to the bottom line.
Now, of the countries, the industrialized countries that are bound by Kyoto, which of them are going to have the hardest time meeting their commitments and why?
Of the industrialized countries that are inside Kyoto, what I call Kyoto land, we're really talking about Europe, Canada, Japan. The ones that are really going to have the hardest time, frankly, are the ones that are already very energy efficient. The best example is Japan. Now, Japan has among the highest energy prices in the world. It's among the most energy efficient economies in the world. It's going to be pretty hard for them to make more cuts and to meet their targets. And that's why they are the keenest on flexibility mechanisms. That's the Kyoto buzzword for things like emissions trading and being able to plant rainforests in Bolivia or trade for projects in Russia that reduce emissions over there and get credits back in Japan, where it might be more expensive to make those same reductions. All these kinds of flexibility mechanisms are what, say, the Scandinavian countries and what Japan will begin to rely on to meet their targets.
Tell me about the ability to trade emissions, so-called, in the Kyoto Protocol. How exactly does that work, and what kind of market, what kind of money are we talking about here?
The emergence of a carbon trading market is potentially a trillion-dollar market that's in the making, along the lines of, say, the commodity markets we have for oil or currencies. The closest analogy is probably America's acid rain trading market, what's called SO2 or sulfur dioxide. The irony is Kyoto and the Europeans are going ahead with the emissions trading for global warming gases that was really pioneered by America in the 90s on acid rain. Listeners will remember, of course, when George Bush, the father, was president, the number one environmental issue wasn't global warming. It was acid rain. And at the time, environmentalists really thought emissions trading, it's somehow immoral. It's trading the right to pollute, because basically government tells companies you can have the right to pollute up to a certain amount of SO2 in the case of acid rain, or CO2 in the case of global warming. And the companies that don't meet that target, they either face a very heavy penalty, or they can buy emissions credits from other companies who find it cheaper to make those cuts. History shows that that actually works. Emissions markets work very well. We've solved our acid rain problem pretty much at much lower cost, much greater efficiency than was previously thought. And so that's really what emissions trading markets are. It's an American innovation that, frankly, America is now left out of in the case of global warming.
Now, much has been made in the United States that developing countries aren't involved in the binding limits under the Kyoto Protocol. But in the original United Nations Framework Convention, the original agreement that resulted in Kyoto, the U.S. agreed with the rest of the industrialized world that since developed nations had gained their wealth in part by using carbon-intensive techniques, that the developing world should get a break on the first round, and that industrialized nations should reduce their emissions first. Now that the U.S. has changed its mind, how does the rest of the world feel about us reneging on this?
The rest of the world is very unhappy about America's seeming demand that countries like China, India, and other developing countries start making cuts now. The way they see it, and frankly I agree with them, is that there's a moral case for the rich countries to act first. We got rich while burning fossil fuels willy-nilly, and we enjoyed the benefits of prosperity, of industrialization, whereas there's still 2 billion people in the world living in absolute poverty without access to modern electricity or any of the conveniences that we take for granted. Nonetheless, if we were to look at it from the perspective of realpolitik, how do we actually break the impasse? I think what's going to happen is for the next round of the Kyoto Treaty, that is after 2012, when the first commitment period ends, we're likely to see participation from some of the big developing countries, and not the really poor sub-Saharan economies, but let's say the China, the Indias, the Brazils, the South Africas, having some kind of token participation.
Tell me, why do you think the United States isn't a part of the Kyoto Protocol at this point?
I think there were both the Bush administration and the Clinton administration misplayed their hand, in my view. Bush, of course, famously stomped out of the Kyoto Treaty, and the Europeans were very upset about this, and the popular history says he's to blame. That's why we left Kyoto, because he hates the environment. There may be truth in that, but in fact, if you look at the history of the 1990s, even though Al Gore, our greenest vice president ever, brought us into signing the Kyoto Treaty, the Clinton administration didn't do anything to help us tackle greenhouse gases while they were in office. So by the end of the miracle economy of the 90s, when our economy was growing tremendously fast, what you found was by the time Bush came around, we would have had to have cut our emissions by a third, I mean a whopping amount, a huge and painful amount, much more than Europe, if Bush had accepted the Kyoto Treaty. So in a sense, I think Bush was ideologically opposed to it, but there were some practical reasons relating to inaction from the Clinton team as well.
Vijay Vaidheswaran is the Energy and Environment Correspondent for The Economist. Thanks for taking this time with me today, Vijay.
My pleasure.
So the United States is not a party to the Kyoto Accord, but as Living on Earth's Jeff Young reports, there are voices calling for action to reduce greenhouse gases echoing through the halls of Congress. And one of them belongs to the senator who was a leader in the first charge against Kyoto.
7 years ago, Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel co-sponsored a non-binding resolution that effectively killed Kyoto in the U.S. Senate. Hagel railed against the treaty's costs to the economy and its lack of any requirements for developing countries to cut emissions. His speeches to business groups were peppered with references to the leading climate change skeptics. Hagel is still talking about Kyoto and climate, but now the setting and tone are decidedly different.
Achieving reductions in greenhouse gas emissions is one of the most important challenges of our time. It is a shared responsibility for all nations. Dealing with global climate policy requires a level of diplomatic intensity and coordination worthy of the magnitude of the challenge.
That's Senator Hagel speaking at the liberal Washington think tank, the Brookings Institution. Quotes from climate skeptics are gone, and he now calls Kyoto a flawed, though noble, effort. In recent weeks, Hagel's talked climate change with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He's even addressed a United Nations climate change panel, all in a push to get the U.S. back in the global warming discussion.
I would hope that the Bush administration would get engaged, and I'll make this a priority. I will continue to push on this. We have been out of the game for 4 years. That's dangerous, it's irresponsible, and we need to address it.
Hagel has introduced legislation that would foster new carbon-capturing technology in the U.S. and make that technology available to developing nations. But Hagel's proposal stops short of actually regulating any carbon emissions. That puts him at odds with the leading climate change bill in Congress, the Climate Stewardship Act, written by Democrat Joe Lieberman and Republican John McCain. The senators say a modest cap on CO2 with an emissions trading mechanism is the best way to spur the development of new technology. Still, McCain says he's glad to have Hagel bring attention to the issue.
We're always pleased to welcome those who have found themselves on the road to Damascus.
If you hear a touch of irony in McCain's voice, it may be that he and Hagel are staking out ground on the global warming issue, positioning for possible runs for president. Yes, we did just finish an election, but here in Washington, eyes are already on 2008. McCain might also worry that Hagel's bill will sap votes from his own initiative. The last Congress defeated the McCain-Lieberman bill, but it won a respectable 43 votes, and the new version of the bill picked up more co-sponsors from both parties. Maine Republican Olympia Snow is on board and says she also hears new support from some U.S. businesses. Snow says the implementation of the Kyoto Treaty changes the playing field in international markets.
Foreign companies and our allies who are participating in that process are going to be developing the cutting-edge technology that could put our companies at a disadvantage. And I think that companies in America are beginning to realize that, and they're realizing the net positive effects.
There's certainly no rush by business to embrace carbon caps. The major lobbies for the electric power and manufacturing industries still oppose the McCain-Lieberman bill, calling it energy rationing. But former Clinton administration official Frank Loy, a veteran of climate change talks, now with the nonprofit Resources for the Future, says business attitudes are slowly changing. Loy says some utility executives have quietly admitted that they think a carbon cap is inevitable and acceptable.
And why are they not vocal? They're not vocal because they are somewhat afraid of crossing the administration on an important issue.
The Bush administration had been largely silent on climate change since withdrawing from Kyoto negotiations, until just the other day.
This is a question on environment, but I was hoping somebody would ask it. I asked myself. Anyway, let me...
At a recent press conference, Bush turned a question about relations with Europe into a brief summary of the U.S. stance on climate. He restated his opposition to Kyoto, but opened the door a bit to the possibility of new international talks focusing on the role of technology.
I spoke to my friend Tony Blair the other day, and I reminded him that here at home we're spending billions on clean coal technology, where we could have, you know, it's conceivable and hopeful we'll have a zero emissions coal plant, which would be not only good for the United States, but it'd be good for the world.
Bush and Blair will likely follow up on that conversation at the G8 summit this summer, where Blair has promised to make climate change a top priority. For Living on Earth, I'm Jeff Young in Washington.
Coming up, the environmental movement, dead or alive? We'll debate that question in just a minute. Keep listening to Living on Earth.